You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Jennifer Cation Armstrong returns to the show this week. In addition to hosting a couple of podcasts, she is the author of several incisive histories of television, including Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything, and Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Her newest book reaches a bit further back and covers a broader canvas and does it all expertly, and the book is When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Now that I've read all of the subtitles of your books, we are out of time. Thank you for being here. I love this book. You're way too young to have written your magnum opus, but in some ways this feels like that's what this is. And I want to really get into it. But before we get into When Women Invented Television, I want to talk a little bit about pop music with you, because your previous book that we talked about not too long ago, Pop Star Goddesses, and How to Tap into Their Energies and Invoke Your Best Self. It's just a brilliant little book that you wrote about pop star goddesses and made it into a self-help book at the same time. Recently we've been in social media kind of occasionally talking about the Grammy Awards that happened recently. Watching the Grammy Awards and seeing Megan Thee Stallion and hearing what she said and the words that she uses, not only in her acceptance speech, but in her song, I think, will people look back 20 years from now and think, wow, that music was really sexist. Now, you and I had a conversation about Britney Spears, about Hit Me One More Time. And you said, I never even thought of Hit Me One More Time as being Hit Me.
Right.
But surely when you look at Megan Thee Stallion.
I don't think she left room for confusion.
Yes.
I think she's very precise. Lyricist. So I do not think we have any problem understanding what that's about. I have to say that, I mean, that performance was clearly like the performance of the night. And it is one of those things where I was like, wow, like this, that is one that is really actually pushing me to the brink of my like, wow, that was really a lot. I am very open-minded and I actually love it. And I think it's a really funny song in a lot of ways. But I was really like, yeah, this is going to get all the parents' attention at home, I think. It was a very memorable performance. Those are some very sexually confident young women.
But, all right. So maybe it's a generational thing. You know, I'm a little older than you, I'm not a prude.
I'll say when we start talking about that performance.
Yeah. I mean, if I went to a strip club, I would expect nothing less. But I didn't go to a strip club. I was watching the Grammy Awards, and not just Megan Thee Stallion, but Dua Lipa. You know, she comes out immediately, takes off her clothes, and does basically stripper moves. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I think in your pop star goddesses, you think about Madonna and what she kind of unleashed. But her Like a Virgin wedding cake, wedding dress number that she did is very tame compared to what is happening now.
That has come up more than once, that particular performance in comparison. And I think it's so funny because it's like when you think of everyone freaking out and then if you could show them immediately after that, this, and you just like, wow, that's, yes, we are even more sexually expressive than in previous years, for sure. I mean, but that and even the video, I remember first seeing the video for WAP and just being like, my goodness, those girls sure do have very clear instructions for their potential lovers. And I suppose that is helpful.
So is it sexually empowering or is it exploitive?
I mean, it's their choice. So I just feel like, you know, that it certainly is centering female pleasure. We can say all of those things. You know, it's a lot. But I'm always wary of accusing women of exploiting themselves when it is their own choice to do so. Because it's so complicated. And it's like, obviously, on the other hand, you don't see Justin Bieber doing that. But no one wants Justin Bieber to do it. No one asked him to do it. And there's no precedent or like weird other societal pressures telling him to do that. So it's a very complicated, this issue of like women exploiting themselves is always so, so complicated, because it's like, whose gaze is it? Who is, you know, who is doing this, who has the agency? I feel like they really have a lot of agency in a way that I would certainly say at times, maybe like Britney Spears does not feel like she had. I would love to say that she always had that, but I don't think she has. Whereas like these young women seem to know exactly what they're doing. Like, I don't have any questions. I don't feel like there's some male producer off screen telling them to do this. This is very much what both of their music is about. This is not a surprise message from them. If you listen to the body of their work, it's all this. And it certainly pushes people's buttons. And, you know, I love that there's also like Fox News is out there like showing it on a loop and being like, isn't this terrible? Let's watch it again. they're clearly doing something, you know, and it's what their art is. And it is, like I said, it's a little much even for me. But it's, I think it's really funny at times. And it's, you know, I was laughing through that whole performance just because I kept thinking of what the reaction was going to be, because it really was, even for me, I was like, okay, you know, I'm even the person who's like, I loved the J-Lo and Shakira halftime show of last year that everyone was like, is this too sexy? Oh my God, we're all gonna die. I would say that the Grammys WAP performance went several steps beyond.
Much, much further.
Yeah. Much and further. It, you know, it's really hard because it's always this generational thing. It's always this. There's always the next generation is gonna come up and be like, you know, try to shock everyone who came before them. And it is very funny to think of like how far we've come from Madonna rolling around in a wedding dress, which like, what was anyone thinking was going to happen as a result? That,
yeah.
That? Like there was nothing, if you could see it as sexy, but like, if you were a kid, you were just like, oh, it's cool that she rolled around in a dress. Like there was nothing you would take from that that would be confusing short of just mommy, what's a virgin, and mom can handle that the way she wants to, you know, it's really not a big deal. Whereas this is, you know, this is definitely, it's so many steps beyond, I can't even think about it.
There was another performance at the Grammys, which for me was the performance of the night, which was Haim. I thought they were really marvelous.
I love them.
And so their song was, it's a beautiful song. It's well-written and well-performed, and it's very modern. And at the same time, it has elements of the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac and Sheryl Crow. And they were very attractive, sexy, mm-hmm. but without being exploitive to that mm-hmm. same degree.
Yeah, I love their vibe. I love everything about them. I loved that whole opening myself because it was Haim and Billie Eilish and Harry Styles. And like, they knew what they were doing, of course, with that. But I just thought like, I loved seeing that those are all really youthful performers, but I felt like, oh, this is music that I want to listen to. And this, I mean, I get it. That's who exactly they're trying to appeal to, people like us. I get that. But it just, they did have this, the whole thing kind of had this a little bit of a throwback vibe, because like Harry Styles kind of has that 70s feel as well. And you want to like buy their records on vinyl and enjoy them and everything. And it's certainly, it's they have a different message from Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion. all the things you want to express.
Well, Billie Eilish, who's, I guess she's 18 now mm-hmm. or 19, you know, she very consciously doesn't reveal anything of her
yes.
physical self. She wears clothes yes. that are attractive, but nevertheless disguise what she looks like.
Mm-hmm. She has said that. And I mean, I watched the documentary on her too, that was on Apple TV Plus.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan. And she's so smart and she has such a strong family. And it's, I found it very, very comforting to watch because it's like the exact opposite of the Britney Spears documentary, which is like, you know, she came along at the same age, you know, she was the same age when she became really famous, like Billie Eilish. And to see the way that Billie Eilish's family has raised her and taken care of her versus the way that Britney's family just is, and there's nothing we can do about it. And that allowed so many forces to take advantage of her in a way that I cannot begin to have, like Billie Eilish, that was never going to happen to her because her mom is like present, but not weird about it. And not overbearing, but is very supportive. Her brother's always with her. There's just so much stuff. She's so smart and her family is so smart and grounded. And she has talked about the fact that she did not want to go down that road of like being exploited. And so she chose that direction for herself. It also makes her into this, you know, Grammy darling, people like us like her, you know, kind of respectability magnet, I think. And it makes us all feel better like, okay, good, which I love her and don't get me wrong, but I think it's very interesting to think of her versus these girls with WAP because it's obviously a very different kind of music. It's a different kind of message. And, you know, there's a racial difference. Like there's a lot of things going on that make that comparison very complicated. And I also bring it up because she used her final acceptance speech to bow to Megan Thee Stallion. Yeah. And so I think that is all we could write a million think pieces.
Before we move away from music, let's talk a little bit about Taylor Swift, because while we were talking, Taylor Swift released 3 albums. Well, she has been, I mean, back in the when I was a kid and the Beatles were popular, the Beatles would put out album every 6 months and yep. It was a big deal. And that's now, I mean, it's been even less than 6 months because mm-hmm. she just put out her version, Taylor's version of Fearless, which wasn't the other version of Fearless, Taylor's version of Fearless also?
It's not anymore. Somebody took it. So yeah. Now this is the one she owns. Yeah, she's such a boss. And I feel like it's like this whole thing with the re-releasing of and re-recording of the albums is so, I mean, this is what I talked about regarding her and Pop Star Goddesses, that she is such a business force and she's so smart about this stuff. And like, how do you make your fans care about like who owns your masters? She did it and made it so that like everyone has to get her albums all over again, the correct version. So she gets the royalties. Like, it's just such a crazy thing that I don't think any artist would have tried in the past, because like who would have thought that anyone cares about this super inside baseball detail of who owns the masters? But she did it, and now she gets to like re-record all her albums and put out cool new covers, and everybody's gonna stream. I did it. I'm a sucker. I, you know, she puts on a bunch of bonus tracks, so I was like, sure, great, I'll take Taylor's version instead. And yeah, she's making the rest of us look like such slouches during the pandemic.
And the thing about the new recording of Fearless is, arrangement-wise, it's true to the original, but her voice is really much, much better.
You can totally hear it. I'm fascinated by this. It's such a nerdy thing, but that's why it's cool in some very nerdy ways that she's doing this. And that to me is like the biggest one. Because she can't help, you know, she can't sing the way she sang that. She just, you can't do that. All you can do is you can try to get close. But she sounds so good.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She's the author of a new book called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today.
Jennifer, when you wrote about television shows before, you could really easily sit down and watch every episode without leaving your couch. Mm-hmm. But when Women Invented Television, you're talking about broadcasts that are as ephemeral as an original Shakespeare production at the Old Globe. I mean, they're gone forever. How different was it to write this book?
I mean, it was different in every single way. Like it's so different. And I mean, that is why I was excited to do it. And I knew it would be a challenge because I mean, it's like, I love my other books, but like, there is it's a certain kind of thing. Like you said, it's like, I even had a little thing that I kind of go through, like, now I'm going to watch every episode. now I'm going to do this, you know, and it like, now I'm going to interview all the people who were involved and most of them are still living. Like everything about this was different. So it's these, a lot of them are lost or bad recordings. They are not necessarily just all on, you know, DVD or streaming somewhere. Three of my four main characters are dead. You know, so it was a lot different, but that's what made it exciting. And so some of it was watchable. You know, I could go to like the Paley Center and see some things maybe that, you know, it's one of the times that you still can really go to the Paley Center and watch some old stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And then, you know, a lot of research in terms of, if I couldn't see a show, what I would do is try to read contemporaneous descriptions. And there were more than I had actually honestly even anticipated, because it turns out like Variety and Billboard in particular were really good even back then. They were really chronicling Hollywood, including the nascent television industry. So they would review a lot of these shows by the week almost. So you'd get these really great descriptions of exactly what had happened and things like that. And also just watching bad recordings of some of them if they were available, or reading scripts is another thing that I did a fair amount. If some actual thing was not available recorded, I could find scripts in some archives and at least read those.
And you just mentioned that you have four main characters, and why don't you tell us who they are and how you came upon them?
Sure. So I'll tell you how I came upon them, upon some of it, and then we'll talk about the others that as I added them. When I was researching my book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show that came out in 2013, I sort of stumbled on a couple of little things that eventually became this book. And one of them was when I was talking to the creators, James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, about the character of Rhoda, who's Mary's best friend on the show. And particularly the fact that she was an openly Jewish character. And I was asking them about some of the inspirations for her and her personality and all of this stuff. And they mentioned Gertrude Berg's character, Molly Goldberg, on the television show The Goldbergs from the late 40s and early 50s. And I did not know her at all. And I thought, you know, I looked her up after I talked to them and was like, I was sort of shocked by how famous she was and how I didn't know her. And that was the first inkling I had of like, oh, there was this woman who created essentially the family sitcom, you know, really helped to invent the family sitcom, and was a huge hit before Lucille Ball. And that to me was the part that I was like, oh, that's interesting. I used to think Lucille Ball was like this outlier. Oh, isn't it interesting that this, the biggest, you know, first big sitcom star we have is a woman. It is interesting and it's so cool and she's great and she's a legend. But like, I really did not know that there were a bunch of women who came before her and did that. And so Gertrude Berg brought the Goldbergs, this family sitcom about a Jewish family in a Bronx tenement. She brought it over from radio. It had been on radio for actually 17 years, which is an extraordinary run. And she was incredibly popular. She was named, you know, she was voted the America's most trusted woman after only Eleanor Roosevelt, as one example. She had a motherhood advice column. There was like a comics version of the Goldbergs. When she brought it over to television, it was so popular. It was such a success. It was the first TV show to become a movie because it was so successful. It went back onto radio because it was so popular on television. They did like a simulcast. She had a line of house dresses. She had a cookbook, like, you know, so she was this huge force, is my point. And I was like, it's crazy that as a person who, you know, of course I was not alive then, but like, just as a person who's interested in TV history and has written several books about it, I didn't know this. And so that to me was interesting. And then another thing that also happened during the research for Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted is that we were talking about the character of Sue Ann Nivens, played by Betty White, and legend, obviously, in this character in particular. I think this is her best work. It's so incredible. But they said that when they created that character, they described her as a Betty White type on camera. And then the joke was sort of like, she's this sweet, you know, almost insipidly sweet person, you know, character on screen. She is the happy homemaker, and she has a show on the station where Mary works. And the minute she gets off camera, she's like a terror, you know, and that's the joke. That's not how Betty White is. But the point was, her on-screen persona was a play on what they call the Betty White type, sickly sweet. And I said, I don't know what you mean, because I didn't know who Betty White was before this character. I didn't know, did not know she had a type. And in fact, when I looked this up, she had this whole kind of like one whole life cycle of a career before the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And she was a talk show host, one of the first, you know, people on television, period. And she had this daytime talk show that she co-hosted in Los Angeles, where she was indeed known for being this very, very sweet character, for better or worse. She wore these flouncy dresses. She was known for her high necklines. She would sing, all of these incredibly wonderful things. Very, very perky. And she indeed was perky for 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
Because they just didn't know what to do in daytime at that time. So they literally just put on Betty White and her co-host, this DJ named Al Jarvis, for 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week. So that
now,
was...
Did any of that exist? Did you were you able to find any...
That show, no. You can't get Hollywood on television on a recorded version. You can only read about it. And she's talked about it, and other people have talked about it. So it's like, that's how I kind of put together some of the information on some of these shows where recordings really just don't exist. You can see her, she eventually gets her own solo national talk show on NBC in 1954, called The Betty White Show. And you can see recordings of that. And I highly recommend looking up recordings of that on the internet, because they are a delight. And you will see this whole idea of the Betty White type that we're talking about. But this was her first incarnation. This was her first big, you know, life cycle on television, was that sort of persona. And she also, as a result of the show, created and starred in her own sitcom called Life with Elizabeth. It sort of spun out of a skit that they would do, her and her co-host, on the show about a husband and wife. And she really became a sitcom star very early as well, and produced and created her own show. So she's another woman who I then found out, like, is doing this thing. And I thought, like, now that's really, you know, now we've got two before Lucy, you know, or around this, actually Betty's a little bit after Lucy, but like around the same time when I again thought Lucy was like this outlier. And that was when I started to dig around and also get more suspicious that this might be a pattern, and ran into, once I did that, you know, a bunch of women doing stuff. And I both creatively, you know, in terms of producing, writing, and also starring in. So that was when I thought, like, oh, there's something here. And, you know, it took me several years to sort of figure out that, feel that I could do it, first of all, because of the challenges we were talking about, but also, you know, to sort of decide to do it and how to do it and all of that. So so those were my first two. And I can tell you about the other two as well, who I kind of added. I basically made a long list after this and then culled it down to four, which, you know, I was following the seminal TV rule of four, right? Seinfeld, Sex and the City. That's four is just enough. You can do a lot, but then you can't do much more than that, because people start to get confused. So so my other two main characters are Erna Phillips, who invented the daytime soap opera first in radio and then brought it over to television. She was asked by her boss in radio at the time to make something that would appeal to women so that they could sell them stuff, so they could have, you know, ads for detergent and things, yeah, on there. And she came up with this idea of essentially, you know, domestic dramas. That was her thought on that. And she really has a lot of massive contributions to what we think of as this genre, because she helps, you know, she really is one of the people kind of creating it and then takes it in some directions that we really still recognize today. There's things that are very silly, like the fact that she is the first one to do the dramatic organ cues, organ music cues that tell you like, this is a really big deal and dramatic.
And there was a reason that it was an organ?
There was a reason it was an organ. And it was because this was for her show, The Guiding Light, which became the longest running broadcast drama ever because it went from radio to television. And that's because it was about the original concept was that there was this priest who would like people would come to you with their problems, which is a great setup for a soap, first of all, because that's why we have so many dramatic problems that they come to the priest.
Right.
And it's because he was a priest. It was an organ in the church.
The church organ. Yeah.
Right. She did a lot of, she was based in Chicago. So she did a lot of, she had a lot of Catholic families, which is a very big thing in Chicago. That was sort of her, she was actually Jewish herself, but she sort of turned all of her, her own stuff into, you know, ran it through this, this Catholic lens, because it was such a prevalent family type in you know, where she lived and grew up. And so she did the organ cues. She was loved a dramatic pause. So, you know, when they all look at each other dramatically after someone says something dramatic, she liked that for a number of reasons. I do think one was that it just helped like convey the message. This is a really big deal. It let it sink in for a minute. She also just liked it because for really practical reasons, you know, these were daily and her actors had to memorize their lines, right? Especially once they were on TV, this was even more important. Radio, you could have your script in front of you, but it's still a lot. And so if you have a dramatic pause, it kind of stretches the whole thing out a little bit longer.
Fills a few more minutes.
Yeah. But I really was in her archive and saw many of her script notes when she would have writers writing for her. She'd, you know, make better use of dramatic pauses.
Wow.
I'm telling you, you know, that sort of thing. So that was hers as well. And she even came up with like more innovations along the way, like using doctors and lawyers as main characters. She loved doctors and lawyers. She had a lot of them in her own life. For a variety, she had a pretty dramatic life herself and had a number of bouts in the hospital, as well as she also was involved in a number of lawsuits. And so she saw the dramatic potential of both of those the same way she saw it in a priest, because it was like, again, it made a little more sense that drama surrounded these people, right? You didn't have to constantly just, I mean, she still did this, torture them, but it made sense that lawyers encounter dramatic things, so do doctors. And so if you think of the impact of that kind of innovation, that we used to not have shows like that, and now it's like, think of how many shows are doctor and lawyer shows, and we all love them, don't we? So, and like, I mean, I watch Grey's Anatomy, and it's, I still think about Erna Phillips all the time when
she
I watch
practically them. Created that show.
She practically, I think that's when I always like to have analogs, like modern analogs for my women, to kind of explain their impact. And I always say she's like the Shonda Rhimes of her time, because she also had multiple shows on the air, both on radio, you know, even in the 40s, she was making $250,000 a year in 40s terms.
Wow. Yeah.
So,
that's a lot.
You know, she was incredibly successful. She was, you know, this mogul. And then eventually when she comes to television, she ends up having something like 7 shows on the air at once that she's had a hand in at some point. So she really was this, like, you know, huge creative force in this one genre.
If the censors who gave Erna Phillips a problem could then see a Scandal where every major character is a murderer.
I mean, absolutely. I think about this a lot. So many innovations in television, especially, and 3 of my 4 characters, like I said, are no longer with us. And the things I think about, like, there's things for each one of them where I think, my God, I wish you could see this. Like, Erna, I wish you could see Bridgerton, you know, or whatever, like, where it's like, can you believe how dramatic stuff has got? And something else that she, of course, like, I don't know how you could really invent this, but she really pushed forward was the cliffhanger. So keeping the viewers interested by leaving them, you know, on the precipice was something she used a lot and really was, you know, a huge force in kind of perpetuating. So that's one that I think about a lot in terms of that's all of Netflix now, you know? Right, so I like to think like if she were around today, she'd have like a really good Netflix deal. Cause she was, you know, like this is true of all of my women, but her particular talent, I think, was really knowing her audience and knowing how to serve them and really fighting for that. And the fourth woman, what is Hazel Scott. And she, the simple way to describe her place in TV history is to say that she was the first Black person to have her own primetime national series. And that's a really big deal. But she was much more than that. There was a lot that led into that, which is that she was an incredibly popular jazz musician. And my analog for her, as I always say, she was the Beyonce of her day. And for a number of reasons, I think that that's true. She was glamorous and beautiful and very clear about how she wanted to be portrayed. She had, you know, rules about what was in her contract. She always had wardrobe approval when she was on a screen. She was in some films as well. She was always credited as herself. It was always Hazel Scott as herself. And that is because that allowed only a very specific kind of character for her to play. She was going to be a successful jazz musician, what, you know, wherever she was seen. And, you know, these were for very good reason. She was a Black woman in the Jim Crow era. And so she also did not play segregated venues. And even though she toured all over the country and sold out stadiums, if she went into a place that she saw was segregated, she'd walk right back out. And then she'd give interviews about it. She used her platform to perpetuate, you know, her feelings about civil rights. And she was married to Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a Black congressman from Harlem. He was a preacher, was very charismatic and handsome himself, and a big civil rights activist as well. So they'd often work together on this stuff and were really, really well known. You know, people wanted to, you know, their marriage was itself this huge event, got a lot of coverage. And people wanted to, you know, they were the kind of couple where people wanted to know, like, what's their home life like? What do they eat? You know, there was this big Ebony story where it was hit, you know, from his perspective, my life with Hazel Scott. And he talked about what a great wife she was and how she cooks chocolate cake, but she's also sexy. And she's, you know, it was this was the level of, you know, fame that they had. And so she was offered the chance to have her own variety show on a network called Dumont, which obviously is now defunct. It was a fourth sort of startup network. And it started out, her show, the Hazel Scott Show, was on Friday nights in the New York City area. And she loved this because it meant she did not have to go around touring anymore. And she had a young son at the time in the New York area, so she could be at home and have her show. And it did so well that it expanded first to multiple nights a week, and then it expanded nationally. And so this was all happening in 1950, and it was kind of like, everything was going really well. She had this multiple nights a week show across the country, expanding all the time, and was getting great reviews. All the reviews I read of it were very effusive and saying basically, you know, we need more of her on screen. So that's kind of the broad setup for all four of the women that I covered.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She's the author of a new book called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today.
One of the things that you do so well in the book, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, is you take material that is like, and I know you did a lot of research, and you researched some like really dry academic kinds of stuff. And you also took, you know, the opposite side, you kind of, you know, anecdotal, and you blended them together in a really wonderful and readable way. And one of the things that really struck me was your description of the Blacklist, in which suspected communists were exiled from the entertainment industry.
Yes.
And you describe it as a protection racket. And I've never quite heard it described that way before. Can you elaborate?
Absolutely. I worked really hard because the thing about the Blacklist that I found anyway is that it's a thing that I thought I kind of knew about it and would kind of, you hear about it and you think like, oh yeah, yeah, the Blacklist, got it. You like, you kind of know. If you have to go describe it, you're suddenly like, wait, how did this work? What would happen? Was there a list? You know, I have many questions. So I really did a lot of research to just figure out how it worked. And then also there are specific instances in the book that are key to my characters. And so I really dug into those. And, you know, a lot of the things with the Blacklist are implication or, you know, it's what we would call like extrajudicial, you know, these are all things that this is not a legal process. No, you know, it's not legal to prosecute people for being a communist in America. So all of it had to be sort of nefarious and secret and implied. And so a lot of it is people not talking publicly about in clear ways about what's happening. So I really had to dig in. And yeah, this is what it turns out, especially at least in television, to this is how it worked. And this is the first instance, 1950 is really the first instance that the anti-communists go after TV because they figure out, oh, this thing, it seems like it's on its way to being really powerful. So it's an indication of how powerful TV is about to become. And it's the first time they really name multiple TV stars. And in TV, the way it worked is that there were groups who, you know, with these hilarious names that would always be like Americans for Justice or whatever, you know, it all sounded like the Justice League or something, because that's what they fancy themselves. But they're really just people who want to accuse other people that they don't like of being communists and then sit back and see what happens. So there's some groups whose job it is to accuse people who often tend to be women, people of color, and Jews, just as a coincidence, you know. Yeah. And then they say things like this list that came out in 1950 from this publication called Counterattack, you know, then Counterattack would say things like, well, we didn't say they're definitely communists. We just said they might be. And so they make a big list that they publish and they put all the things they think, you know, groups they think these people might've been associated with, et cetera. And then they say, you make your own decision. And then what happens is this comes out and it implies that these people are, quote, controversial. And then there's other groups that say, we will vet your potential stars. You know, they're basically like former FBI agents who will go snooping around. And they say, if you want to run all your stars by us, we'll let you know if they might be, quote, controversial or not. So then they charge the networks to do this. And they were often associated with the other groups that put out the lists. So there's people who drum up the, you know, suspicion. And then there's others who say, we'll protect you from these suspicious characters. And then there's other people whose job it is just to like write a letter to the networks and the sponsors saying, we're concerned that this person seems to have shown up on this list that my friend over at that other place makes, and we think you should fire them. And so this was like this circular system that went on, and it actually didn't, it seemed like for a second, like the list came out, this was confusing to me in my research at first, the list comes out and nothing happens at first. And you're like, oh, this is weird. It's not like the list came out and everybody got fired. But then there was a woman named Jean Muir, who is not a character in my book, but she gets fired from a show called The Aldriches. It was like a family sitcom. And somewhat, you know, there were a few letters that people wrote, and General Foods fires her and they're successful. General Foods says, you know, we have to fire this woman. And everyone involved with the show says, okay, she's fired. And they're like, oh, we didn't think that would work. And it did. So then all the other sponsors start kind of like agitating and trying to get people fired, and people start reacting preemptively and all of this stuff. And there's kind of this whole panic that ensues. And it's the first time this happens to television. And, you know, it's not a good look. It's not cool to just be running around firing people for no apparent reason, except somebody put them on this list that they say may or may not have any relevance. So this does snag two of the women in my book, in particular, Hazel Scott, who we just left on a cliffhanger in a way. I was saying everything was going great with her show, which just tells you it was about to not be. And she decides, because of her previous activism, I think in particular, she's very outspoken, and she decides she's named on the list and is very protective of her career and her TV show, and decides she's going to go before the House Un-American Activities Committee voluntarily, and in fact demands to go. They do not want her. And this was very unusual. Usually you would go kind of kicking and screaming if you were called, maybe, or you'd refuse to go. Her idea was, let's try something else. You know, I'm going to go and I'm going to explain to them what they're doing wrong. And her husband was like, maybe not, maybe don't. And, you know, he was pretty outspoken himself, but he was like, I feel like this is not going to go well, at least according to their son, who told me this. And, you know, she says, no. This is, and her son was also like, I knew when my mother got something like this in her, this is what she was going to do. And she actually, they at first were like, our schedule is really busy, you can't come. And she insisted, she called a press conference. She put out her statement anyway, and they finally said, okay, fine, you can come. And if you think about this Black woman going before a panel of old white men, one of whom had Ku Klux Klan ties, to be like, let me tell you how you are doing everything wrong. I mean, this is incredibly brave. And the fact that she was kind of risking something to do it. But she felt like this was what she had to speak up, and she thought it might work. She thought she might clear her name and everything would be okay. And she gave an incredible speech, and I quoted at length in the book, and got back home. And unfortunately, it is not the hero's story you want it to be. It is not like, then everyone rallied around her and realized the blacklist was stupid and ran it out of, you know, television. But instead, suddenly Dumont couldn't find a sponsor anymore. They actually just preemptively canceled her show. No one complained. They just said, oops, you know what? We don't need this kind of hassle. And even though it was doing really well, they just dropped her. They didn't try to find another sponsor, from what we can tell. It's, you know, it's murky, but this seemed to be the case. And so she had this beautiful 1 year, glorious year of like this great rise in television in 1950. And really feels like, to me, it feels like she was positioned so great. Like if that had not happened and she had just been able to continue, she would have gone into the, you know, more mid 50s when everyone was starting to get a television and could have been positioned to be this big television star and have her lovely dream job where she could stay in New York and perform, and it would have been great. And she could have really had much more influence on television in particular. She still was a great jazz musician and is regarded as, you know, an important one. But I think more people would know her name in a Nat King Cole kind of way, who did come along in the mid 50s and have his own variety. Yes,
I remember reading at some point, you know, that he was the first Black to have
his own show. It was kind of like, what's funny about some of these firsts is it's hard for any of them. It's like you could always end up being proven wrong that some weird frequency somewhere way back in history had somebody before this. But also, like in that particular case, like they were friends. And so she was actually, you know, according to her son, a little irritated when he was running around. And he, in some ways, he really was the Jackie Robinson of television, because he was doing it at a time when TV had reached kind of mass, you know, penetration in the United States. And so that is a bigger deal in a sense. But, you know, in another sense, like he just completely seemed to forget that his friend had done this before him, and she was a woman, incidentally. So she really was before him in this regard. And I think it's also extraordinary that she, you know, that she was the first Black person to do it, and she was a woman. So it's another indicator of what we were talking about, that women were actually doing quite a bit in those early days of television, and we didn't realize it, and they have been forgotten to a large extent.
But now, brought back to life.
That's right.
In this wonderful book, When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today. And the author, the brilliant Jennifer Cation Armstrong. So wonderful to have you back on the show, and I hope we see you again soon.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.